Good evening and welcome to the final lecture of the first annual series of the Lillian and Maury Moss Endowment for the Visual Arts. This has been a very successful inaugural series. We're grateful to the members of Evergreen Presbyterian Church for allowing us to use their beautiful sanctuary. When we made the decision to move from Hardy Auditorium on the Rhodes campus over to Evergreen, it was not because we expected to fill the rafters of the church, but because we wanted to be sure that you would be comfortable and that every person would have an unobscured view of the screen. I think you'll agree that Maury Moss' vision to bring a greater understanding and enjoyment of the visual arts to Rhodes and to Memphis is already coming to reality. Because of his generosity in establishing the Moss Endowment for the Visual Arts, we can look forward to visits each year from artists and scholars in the field of the visual arts who are in the pinnacle of their professions. Although Mr. Moss could not be with us here tonight, he will hear a tape of the lecture, and I hope you will join me in expressing our thanks for this wonderful inaugural series. I'll tell on him just a little bit. He is, because of a prior engagement, studying the form and texture and line of the horses at the Kentucky Derby in Louisville. Tonight we welcome Patricia Hills to the lectern of the Moss series. She is Associate Professor of Art History at Boston University and adjunct curator of the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York. Professor Hills is a graduate of Stanford University and of Hunter College of the City University of New York, and holds the PhD from New York University. Dr. Hills is a recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, and she has a special grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities for her work in the John Singer Sargent exhibition scheduled for the Whitney and the Art Institute of Chicago in 1986-87. Patricia Hills is widely published, with particular emphasis in American art. Her most recent books include Alice Neal, published in 1983, and a work on John Singer Sargent to be published this fall. Tonight, Dr. Hills will look at American portraiture from Copley to Warhol. She is an outstanding teacher, scholar, curator, author, lecturer. And it is an honor for us at Rhodes College to present Dr. Patricia Hills.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here in Memphis and also in Rhodes College. Thank you. A portrait is a negotiation between an artist and history, with, of course, the complicity of the sitter. Saying that, I might also quote a famous thinker and activist of the 19th century. Quote, "Men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered, given, and transmitted from the past." End quote. In other words, tradition is a strong component of portraiture, but artists can certainly be innovative. It turns out that the innovations come about when the artist feels and then acts to or reacts against those changes in history, those changes which the artist experiences in social, political, and economic life. This evening, I would like to investigate the portraiture of three different epochs by showing you slides of six representative painters. We will see the transformation of the portrait from the heroic age of the merchant class of the late 18th century to the cosmopolitan and imperialist age of American capitalism of the end of the 19th century, to the age of the media-hyped commodity of consumer capitalism today. The artists discussed will be John Singleton Copley and Charles Wilson Peale for the end of the 18th century, Thomas Aikens and John Singer Sargent for the end of the 19th, and Alice Neal and Andy Warhol for today. May I have the first two slides, please? For our first artist, John Singleton Copley, Copley was born in Boston in 1738. His early training in art occurred in the shop of his stepfather, Peter Pelham, an engraver of mezzotint prints from England. At that time, an artist learned his craft by copying English prints, which Copley did. On the left, you see Princess Anne, a mezzotint after Wissing, which was used by Copley for his early portrait of Mrs. Joseph Mann on the right. This painting, done when the boy was a mere 15 years old, is simplified and flat, but it is a pleasing likeness, and Copley was off to a good start, painting merchants and their wives in styles that they would recognize as being mainstream English. 10 years later, Copley had achieved considerable skill when he painted Mrs. Daniel Sargent in 1763. Again, the pose, setting, and accessories come from English prints, but the quality of the fabric that has been rendered exquisitely. This was the result of Copley's sharp observation of empirical reality. There is also greater individuality into her face than we have seen in the portrait of Mrs. Joseph Mann. In spite of her fancy dress, the face seems to be an accurate rendering of a highly intelligent woman. Eager to ascertain the real merit of his skills, in 1765 he sent the portrait of his young half-brother, Henry Pelham, which you see on the right, called Boy with a Squirrel, to England to be shown at the Society of Artists. Young Henry is sitting at a table holding a ground squirrel on a chain with a glass of water placed nearby. It is a display of sharply observed reality. The textures of fur, hair, curtain, mahogany table are faithfully rendered, as are the delicate chiaroscuro of the head's modeling and the draping of the background curtain. The ship captain, who had brought the painting there to England, reported to Copley that Joshua Reynolds considered it an excellent of the disadvantages that Copley labored under. Benjamin West, a fellow American living in London, wrote to Copley urging European study in order to develop his talents further. But in spite of Copley's views of the provinciality of Boston taste, he was developing his talents in his own hometown. He was associating with men who were negotiating their version of history, and this spurred him to develop his own version of the Enlightenment portrait. Now, this is a term that was used by H.W. Jansen to describe other portraits. The Enlightenment portrait, typical of the late 18th century, is one that partakes of the spirit of the emerging bourgeois class, enlightened, progressive, and rational, as opposed to the frothy concoctions of aristocratic court art. Let me show you what I mean. That same year, 1765, Copley painted John Hancock on the left, the Boston merchant who saw it necessary to ally himself with the radicals' cause. A couple of years later, Copley painted the silversmith, Paul Revere, which you see on the right, in a starched white shirt holding a silver teapot, which he has been working on. In both portraits, there is a directness of vision, a no-nonsense quality. The Paul Revere is perhaps the most radical artistically, but they both share the same Enlightenment spirit. In America, where aristocratic values had not been strong, the bourgeois values, particularly those celebrating work, infused the sermons and educational tracts of the day. In these two portraits of merchant and artisan, they are surrounded by the attributes specific to their means of livelihood. The ledger books on the left with Hancock, the silver teapot with Revere on the right. In that fluid pre-revolutionary society, class differences between artisans such as Revere and rich merchants such as Hancock hardly mattered. The Revere portrait is remarkable as the first instance in American art when an artist captured the informal moment when a craftsman looks up from his work to engage the viewer. The tactile and detailed realism of the painting and Revere's forthright expression give the portrait a startling presence that underscores Revere's equality with Copley, who, as an artist, was also a member of the artisan class on his way up. In the late 1760s, as a matter of fact, Copley began buying property on Beacon Hill. A more startling portrait is that of Samuel Adams on the left, done about 1772. Let me digress now to history. Between 1768 and 1772, there was a ferment of revolutionary activity in and around Boston, of which Copley played a reluctant part. Try as he might to remain neutral, and this was a better position to be in if one is a portrait painter looking for patrons, Copley was nevertheless drawn into the events. In 1769, he had married Susanna Clark, the daughter of Richard Clark, the Boston merchant and high Tory, who acted as the agent for the British East India Company. At this very time, Copley's clientele had shifted from the disproportionately high percentage of Tories, some 72%, that he had been doing in the early years of his career, toward the particularly strong Whig predominance, some 70%, at the end, in those years 1771 to 74. Copley was thus caught between two forces, the radical Whigs, who were becoming his new patrons, such as Hancock, Revere, and Adams, and the high Tories, such as his father-in-law, Clark. Clark was not just the consignee of the tea which had come into Boston Harbor and which had had a stiff tax applied to it. He was also the nephew of the hated Governor Thomas Hutchinson. Copley tried to mediate between the Clarks and the Sons of Liberty, but failed. As we know, the Sons of Liberty dumped Clark's tea into Boston Harbor in 1773. In this context, let us look again at Copley's portrait of Samuel Adams on the left. This painting is actually a history painting showing Adams as he appeared when confronting Governor Thomas Hutchinson after the Boston Massacre of March 5th, 1770. There is clarity, action, and immediacy. The figure emerges out of the darkness, a beacon of civic responsibility and leadership. My thesis is that Copley would not have painted such a dynamic portrait if men then making history had not urged him to do so, and if not he himself had felt the passion of those times. The portrait was apparently commissioned by John Hancock, who asked Copley to paint another picture of himself and his friend Adams, both of whom had been reelected to the House of Representatives in 1772. It seems that in his realization of his role in history, Hancock wanted the immortalization of Copley's brush. Copley's portraits of women, such as Mrs. Ezekiel Goldthwaite on the left and Mrs. Richard Skinner on the right, share this Enlightenment style. Mrs. Goldthwaite's portrait has the same clarity of vision, but the composition emphasizes the rounded forms of her ample body and the peaches which she herself cultivated. Mrs. Skinner sits alert to what is taking place off the canvas. With her hand to her head, Copley emphasizes her acute intellectual qualities. Copley's contemporary, Charles Wilson Peale, is probably my favorite artist in the history of American art. He was an artist, a family man, inventor, scientist, museum director, educator, entrepreneur, inventor, I said that, patriot, and radical Whig. He was born in 1741 in Maryland, but was apprenticed to a saddler and woodcarver, turned to art, and eventually went to England in 1767, where he furthered his artistic training with Benjamin West. He returned to his wife in Maryland and launched what was to be a successful painting career, painting General Gist on the left about 1770-72, and General George, called Cadwallader, his wife and child on the right, about 1772. The linear hardness of Copley's portrait is softened somewhat in the image's appeal, but there is the same clarity. Peel's different personality differed, the Enlightenment style was different from Copley's, and the Enlightenment style certainly allowed for variations. To me, the softness suggests Peel's affection for people. And indeed, the portrait of the Peel family on the left, begun about 1773 and finished about 1808. In this portrait, Peel's qualities as a family man and an artist come through. We have a detail on the right here. In this large painting, we see Charles turning from painting a picture of the three graces on his easel. He's at the upper left. He's turning to supervise his brother, St. George, who is in turn drawing their mother and one of Peel's children at the right end of the table. The person next to St. George is their brother, James. There's another child and Peel's wife, Rachel, two sisters, one standing, one next to her mother, and the nurse, Peggy Durgan, standing behind. Argus is the dog in front. The busts on the mantle are of Benjamin West, Peel himself, and an English benefactor. Thus incorporated into this painting are children. Peel did have 17 children in all. His family, and he encouraged all of his brothers and supported them during their lean times. His servant, who appears there on an equal footing with the family, and there is a reference to his own educational activities and involvement with art. In the mid-1770s, Peel was caught up in the politics of the times as an active participant for the radical Whig cause. In 1775, he did a banner, Representation or No Taxation. He wrote to West in England regarding the impossibility of being neutral, quote, those who do not enter the impending fight with us are against us, end quote. In 1776, he moved to Philadelphia. Hancock, as president of Congress, ordered full-length portraits of George and Martha Washington, which Peel finished in late 1776. The painting on the left of George Washington, done in 1776, may be a variant on that portrait. In spite of the ferment, 1776 was a great year for painting, and Peel finished 65 portraits that year. He also joined the militia, becoming a lieutenant with 81 men under his command, and they participated in the Battle of Princeton during January 1777. At one lull during the fight, Peel, who had been trained as a saddler, sat down and made his men moccasins from some leather that he had bought. Back in Philadelphia, Peel joined with Tom Paine and others in the leadership of the left wing of the Whigs, supported by artisans, tradesmen, and the backcountry farmers. They supported such measures, considered radical then, as public education from primary grades to university and the abolition of slavery. However, the right wing of the Whigs, the merchant class, represented by such people as Gouverneur and Robert Morris on the right, gained control of the provisional government. In 1779, George Washington posed for the portrait Washington at the Battle of Princeton on the left. Peel made trips to Princeton and Trenton for the background. Washington stands erect, towering over the battlefield as he confidently That's the barrel of a large gun. About 1780, Peale decided to form a national portrait gallery of great men of the Revolution, a gallery that would be open to the public. He began a series of portraits, including Benjamin Franklin on the right, done about 1785. He built a picture gallery onto his house, the first skylighted gallery in America. The idea of the gallery expanded to include a museum of natural science, and for the next several years, he occupied himself with building up collections of specimens and promoting this museum. He introduced moving pictures to his museum, as well as lectures on science, and all of these enterprises involved his sons. In 1794, he announced that he was giving up painting. However, he did paint the staircase group, which you see on the left, and the slide at the right is actually the way the picture looks when it is exhibited the way that Peale had originally done it. It's a very trompe l'oeil portrait, as you can see, with an actual built-out step on the right. This was done of his two sons, Titian above and Raphael below. By the way, Peale named all of his children after famous artists. There was Angelica Kauffman Peale, there was Titian, there was Rembrandt Peale, Raphael Peale, a number of other artists as well. This work was painted as a showpiece for the first and only exhibition of the Columbianum, or American Academy of Fine Arts, which Peale was instrumental in starting. This academy was the first to form an art school, and it held the first contemporary group exhibition in America with 137 works. The organization folded after a couple of years because of lack of support. Peale later was involved in organizing the Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts, still a lively school and museum. Science in his museum dominated most of Peale's sunlit hours for the rest of his life. Exhuming the Mastodon, done in 1806 on the left, commemorates his activities of 1801. Mastodon bones were discovered on the farm of a man by the name of John Maston in New York. Peale bought the bones for $200 plus $100 for the rights to dig. He spent 5 months and $1,000 exhuming the bones. The bones were displayed December 24, 1801, and the painting was completed in 1906 to celebrate the event. On the right, in that portrait, you'll see a number of small figures. They were portraits of Peale and his family who were involved in the dig. A final work I want to discuss is The Artist in His Museum of 1822 on the right, painted when Peale was 81 years old. Here he holds up the red Baroque curtain, a stock accessory of traditional portraiture. He is the impresario and director of a museum with specimens of birds and animals classified according to the latest scientific system. The portraits of revolutionary notables are hung high up on the wall. Behind the curtain, you see visitors moving among the exhibits, educating themselves to the ways of the natural world. To sum up Peale's life, he was a man of his times, involved, engaged, shaping the society in which he lived. He was an enlightened man. He deplored the institution of slavery. He taught all of his black servants a trade and then gave them their freedom. He was a friend of or corresponded with every scientific man of consequence of that era and was a confidant of Thomas Jefferson. When Jefferson sent off expeditions to the West, Peale's son Titian Ramsay Peale II was in the party to record the topography and the flora and fauna sighted along the way and to bring back specimens for the museum and the benefit of the public. All of these facts are contained in his magnificent portrait. Let us move now to the end of the 19th century. Thomas Aikens, another Philadelphian, was born about 100 years after Peale in 1844, the son of a professional writing master. Aikens went to Central High School, the Pennsylvania Academy, and then to France in 1866 to study with Jerome at the École des Beaux-Arts. He returned in 1870. Philadelphia in 1870 had changed considerably from the city of 100 years earlier, but the scientific community still thrived. One of Aikens' first commissioned portraits after his return was Professor Benjamin Howard Rand on the left, done in 1874. Here we see Rand on the faculty of the Jefferson Medical College, absorbed in his scientific study, in his professional work, too busy to look up. He is surrounded by the scientific instruments of his profession. In 1875, Aikens painted the Gross Clinic on the right, celebrating a moment when Dr. Samuel Gross pauses in the operation of a femur to lecture to the students of Jefferson Medical College seated in the amphitheater. This is a heroic portrait, not of the man of politics, but of the man of science, one who seems to be above nationality and regional interests and who seeks the truth. In the detail, we can see how Aikens adopts the Rembrandtesque technique of focusing the light in his brushwork on the head of Gross, who looms above the attending physicians. Aikens placed himself in the picture, but modestly, and to the side. You just barely see it. It's at the very, very edge. In fact, you can't really see it in the slide, but he's there. By the time of Aikens, painters were no longer in the thick of the political life of their country, although they could, like Aikens, be involved with the scientific community. They were more and more being relegated to the realm of culture, which was seen as separate from real life. The separation began in earnest after the Civil War, when men such as Matthew Arnold advocated the pursuit of perfection, the pursuit of sweetness and light, beauty and intelligence by men of culture. Later, George Santayana lamented the division of American society into two spheres, the practical and the cultural. Quote, the one is all aggressive enterprise, the other is all genteel tradition, end quote. The genteel tradition included the worlds of art, music, and literature, and often, and quite naturally, artists and writers took women as their object of study. Aikens's paintings of the 1880s and 1890s show this trend. On the left, the Pathetic Song, painted in 1881, depicts a Miss Harrison singing a song in the interior of a middle-class home. At the piano sits Susan McDowell, whom Aikens was to marry. On the right is Lady with a Setter Dog, and this shows Susan, by then married to Aikens, sitting in an interior, holding a book of Japanese prints in her lap. Both are traditionally composed with light used to focus on the forms, and both the figures are surrounded with the accessories of culture, oriental vases, pictures on the walls, and oriental carpets. But the emphasis is on the intellectual activity of the figure. Let us look at the detail of Susan's fingers. Susan Aikens, Susan was a painter. She had been a student of Aikens at the Pennsylvania Academy. This detail shows the fingers sort of pulsing and alive. The fingers and the hands are, after all, the instrument that the painter uses when she paints. But what I think really strikes one looking at this picture is this deep melancholia that you see pervading her face. Other typical Aikens portraits, Mrs. Frischmuth of 1900 with her musical instruments, and the cellist on the right of 1892. Both of these figures are absorbed in their occupations. Mrs. Frischmuth is surrounded by her musical instruments. She hits one note on the piano, and she seems sort of lost in thought. The cellist, of course, is absorbed in his music. This mood of absorption in one's own thoughts characterizes many late 19th century paintings, but particularly Aikens's work. When you see a work such as this one on the left of Miss Van Buren of 1891, just recall the work we saw by Copley of Mrs. Richard Skinner. Now, of course, this image of the woman lost in her thoughts, you also see over in the Memphis Brooks Museum of Art. Joshua Reynolds did Mrs. Way in 1761. But this is a kind of motif that you see much, much more frequently at the end of the 19th century, and particularly in the work of Aikens. In 1887, Aiken's painted on the right, Walt Whitman. The shaggy poet sinks into the background. He was, in fact, ailing at the time. The poet said of Aiken's, quote, Tom's portraits, which the formalists, the academic people, won't have at any price, are not a remaking of life, but life. It's manifest, just as it is, as they are, end quote. At the turn of the century, Aiken's painted himself and his wife. Left, you see Susan Aiken's of 1899, and on the right, the self-portrait of 1902. In his own portrait, where he is slightly hunched over, his face is careworn, with none of the self-confidence of Peale. Although Aiken's kept abreast of scientific developments, including experiments with photography, the deep melancholia of his late portraits reveals a man no longer sure of his place in the world of affairs. The turn of the century expansionist spirit had passed him by. He, like other artists, could negotiate only a marginal place for history. We turn now to John Singer Sargent, a man who came to artistic maturity when little else was expected of the artist than to provide a dazzling and acceptable image of a social leader. Sargent was born in 1856 in Florence, to American expatriate painters. The special circumstances of his birth and upbringing indelibly shaped his artistic character and personality. His father had been a surgeon in Philadelphia, but his mother insisted on a peripatetic life abroad. The winters they spent in Florence and Nice, and the summers they traveled to the mountains or various spas. They lived a life with comforts, but without extravagance. And Sargent grew up, forming no attachments except to his family and a handful of family friends. And he developed no strong allegiance to country or locale, although in a vague way, he always thought of himself as an American. This international and cosmopolitan life created a sensibility whereby he was a perpetual sightseer in a world filled with the exotic other. His childhood friend, Violet Paget, who wrote under the pen name Vernon Lee, tried to capture the essence of his childhood character when she wrote a memorial essay after his death. And I'm quoting Lee, quote, the words strange, weird, fantastic were already on his lips, and that adjective curious, pronounced with a long and somehow aspirated U, accompanied by a particular expression, half of wonder and half of self-irony. End quote. The strange and the fantastic, the otherness of the world, were to have a continuing appeal to Sargent, who kept up the pace of traveling to exotic lands until the end of his life, and who numbered among his friends eccentric artists, colorful writers, and outrageous society women. To Sargent, the affairs of government or of science held no interest. He was interested in art, in culture, in the sweetness and light which Arnold advocated. From the rest of the world, he was detached. From the beginning, his art was brilliant in technique, dazzling in its radiant surface effects, and cosmopolitan in its range of subjects. He entered the studio of the celebrated French portrait painter, Carolus Duran, in 1874, and learned his lessons well. One of his first notable portraits is of his teacher, Carolus Duran, which we see on the left. It is like a textbook illustration of Carolus's own method, and it is concerned with values, with light, with lights and darks in a painting. The method is this, that Carolus had taught. You begin with the middle tones and work up toward the highest lights and down to the darkest darks. Then you add the finishing touches, the virtuoso brushwork, and the glint of color to make the surface come alive. It should look effortless, sweet, and light. The portrait of Madame Pierron, you see here on the right, of 1879 is a similar virtuoso exhibition of feathery brushwork and caressing painterliness. In 1882, Sargent painted on the left the daughters of Edward D. Boyd, the children of his friend, the American painter. How different from the children in Peale's portrait. Isolated from each other, they act to decorate the room with their sprightly presence. In 1884, Sargent painted Madame Gautreau on the left, and it was shown at the Salon as Madame X. It was a portrait of the, quote, professional beauty, end quote, a phrase the French adopted from the English. Gautreau, like Sargent, was an American eager to break into French society. Her audacious and mannered pose and haughty profile, her lavender coloring and décolletage were calculated to shock the public. Sargent wrote to a friend that he admired her, quote, strange, weird, fantastic, curious, end quote, beauty. Earlier, he had painted, on the right, the celebrated gynecologist Dr. Pozzi. In a letter to Henry James, Sargent called Pozzi a very brilliant creature, whom he admired more for Pozzi's taste in art and first edition books than in the doctor's surgical skills. How unlike Dr. Benjamin Rush, or the Gross Clinic, which we have already seen that were done by Aikens. Pozzi, reputed to be Madame Gautreau's lover, is dressed for the boudoir rather than the operating room. In December of 1889, Sargent made his second trip to America to paint portraits, and I want to show you one from that trip. One of the portraits on the left, Mrs. Livingston Davis and her son, painted for the Worcester Industrialists. Let me compare it with a work that he did on the right, Lady Warwick and her son. The American portrait on the left shows us a woman simply dressed, one who is both presenting and protecting her son. The Lady Warwick portrait is a concoction inspired by 18th century portraiture of the English aristocracy. The outdoor sky and setting looks more like a theatrical backdrop, one which a Gainsborough would have done, than a real sky. One would never know, looking at this portrait on the right, that Lady Warwick was an ardent and active socialist. By painting her as a matronly aristocrat, he trivializes her work and social causes. Another telling comparison is Sargent's painting Mr. and Mrs. Ian Phelps Stokes of 1896 on the left, and the Marlborough family of 1905 on the right. This was recently in Washington in the Country Houses exhibition. The simplicity and spontaneity of the American couple on the left contrast with the royal and static demeanor of the other. When I was at Blenheim looking at this portrait, this one on the right in the slide is one that I took when I was at Blenheim, a tour guide came through with about a dozen or so tourists. This tour guide had no use for Consuela Vanderbilt, whom you see there, the Duke's American wife. To convince the audience of Consuela's vulgarity, the tour guide said that Consuela used to refer to her two sons there as the heir and the spare. The Stokes portrait on the left is, I think, much more appealing, and it comes as close as Sargent ever got to painting the spirit of the new woman of the turn of the century. Sargent certainly painted the female English aristocracy with sympathy, however, but on their own terms, which was to render them as graceful objects. Lady Agnew of 1892 on the left takes my vote as one of his very best portraits. And why? Because there is a strong impression of character playing about her lips. A smile comes through her eyes. A tenseness of the head seems to contradict the languor of the body. The other portrait you see on the right, the Wyndham sisters, painted in 1900, presents women who did have some notable literary accomplishments, but here they are reduced to being accessories in a display of yards of taffeta. After 1907, there was a precipitous falling off of portraits in Sargent's verve. He made no bones about his revulsion in doing them. He wrote to a friend, quote, no more portraits. I abhor and abjure them and hope never to do another, especially of the upper classes. They were too much, even for Sargent. In the Belle Epoque, the aristocracy itself was marginalized, reduced to ceremonial functions and displays of conspicuous consumption. Let me finish with a comparison between our two 19th century artists, Sargent and Aikens. They both did portraits of the painter William Merritt Chase. Sargent presents a dashing artist about to duel an image onto a canvas. He is on stage, a performer. Aikens' image is of a more thoughtful man staring off the canvas. These portraits tell us more about the two portrait painters than about the sitter, William Merritt Chase. Aikens understood the transitions going on in art and culture, and he must have grieved the marginalization that he felt himself experiencing. Sargent, on the other hand, buried himself in his mural projects for the Boston Public Library, painting symbols of a Christian faith far removed from the superficiality of his social world. When art for art's sake achieved its victory at the end of the 19th century, the artist lost all moral force. We move now to the mid to late 20th century. In general, the artist in our century has been relegated to the world of entertainment. If they are lucky or enterprising, they can become media stars, a status which allows them greater opportunity to promote their artistic products. But there was a time in the 1930s when artists became active in political affairs. At that time, they felt a common bond with the unemployed and destitute because they themselves were out of work. Many artists threw their energies into the New Deal projects, the most far-reaching of which was the Works Progress Administration that employed some 5,000 artists throughout the country. Other artists joined radical political organizations because they believed that their own involvement would help the cause of equality and justice in America. It was this involvement that sparked the dynamic portraiture of the early Alice Neal, such as the one on the left, Portrait of Kenneth Fearing of 1935, and the one on the right, Pat Whalen, also of 1935, which has recently been purchased by the Whitney Museum. Alice Neal was born in 1900 and brought up in a Philadelphia suburb. Her father was a clerk who worked for the Pennsylvania Railroad. After high school, she worked about 3 years to get funds for art school. After 4 years of art school, she married a Cuban from a well-to-do family. But in her late 20s, she suffered a series of tragedies. Her first child died of diphtheria, and her husband absconded with the second daughter, leaving Neal high and dry in New York City. Torn between despair over the loss of her child and anger at her husband, and the elation because she could paint now undisturbed, she became emotionally distraught and had a nervous breakdown. After a year in a sanatorium, she emerged a stronger painter than ever. Kenneth Fearing, the one you see on the left, was a radical poet who wrote the best proletarian poetry in America. Neal has surrounded him with the characters from his poetry. The police, there's a man shot dead on the sidewalk, and another man selling the Daily Worker. The skeleton was to show that his heart bled for the grief of the world. Kenneth Fearing, by the way, is very much a kind of in the background of the poems of Allen Ginsberg. You can see Allen Ginsberg coming out of that tradition. Whalen, on the right, was a Communist Party organizer who worked with longshoremen on the waterfront. Neal has caught his dynamic personality as he sits pounding his fist on the table at the right. His portrait is a modern version of Copley's Samuel Adams. Neal was caught up in these causes, participating in demonstrations and joining radical organizations. Her portrait of a relative of Jose, the father of her older son, called T.B. Harlem of 1940, is one of the most moving of the decade. But during the late 40s and 1950s, while she was raising her two sons, she dropped into oblivion, although she never stopped painting during those difficult years.